I gotta take those off.
Okay. My name is Francina Turner, and I am conducting the oral history interview with Kenny Holiday.
I prefer if you pronounce it Keen.
Keen.
With yes, Keen right. Holiday. K-E-N, Keen, K-E-N-E, Keen okay. Holiday.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Keen Holiday for the Reparative Histories and the Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. So Mr. Holiday, the way this is kind of structured is I'll ask you some questions about your life before UMD. We'll talk about UMD and then a little bit about your experiences since UMD. So we'll start now, with-
What does the B stand for?
No, UMD.
Oh, University UMD, okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. No problem. Because uh-huh. we used to have a ton of satellite colleges oh, yes. that are now part of the university system. Okay, so mm-hmm. you go right ahead.
Okay, what's your hometown?
I'm from New York City, New York. I was okay. raised in a place called Amityville, Long Island.
Okay. And what's your birthday?
6/25/1949.
Okay. How would you describe your life before you came to the college, before you came to College Park? And in terms of your like family composition, that kind of thing.
Well, by the way, do you have enough light on me?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I can see.
Okay, fine. Actually, I was you know, a high school athlete and somewhat of an academician. But I wasn't one of the A-plus guys. I usually hovered around B-plus. Mm-hmm. But my athletics were extraordinary. I was all Long Island, a football player. I was running back, scored a lot of touchdowns, played really serious football. Mm-hmm. And I also was a track star, 100-yard dash champion, county champion in the 100-yard dash in my junior year, and was on my way to repeating that in my senior year when I pulled a hamstring in one of the preliminary events. And so that kind of took me and my relay team out of the running there. But I had established such a great reputation in my athletics with the football and the track the prior year that they were, and my academics, like I said, were in very good shape for recruiting prospects. And so I was recruited by schools all over the Northeast, even the military universities were trying to recruit me, Annapolis and West Point. And so I decided I wanted to leave the New York area because I was tired of the cold weather. I played football on sometimes the ground was as hard as a concrete street. So I decided I wanted to go someplace that was more climate friendly. And a gentleman from the University of Maryland contacted my coach and asked if he could interview me. And Raffaele was his last name. I missed his first name. Mr. Raffaele interviewed me and came to my home and talked to my mom. My father had passed away when I was 12, and he was a United States Navy veteran, 14 years of service in World War II. And they set up a visitation for me to come down to the university and have a visit. And I did that. And I got down there and the weather was so nice. It was really nice weather. And the school was enormous and incredibly impressive. The campus itself, they were telling me, said, we have 24 colleges housed here on this university. So anything that you want to study, we more than likely have it here. And so they took me downtown. They said, by the way, we're only six miles away from the Washington, D.C. border. So we're going to take you on a little tour. So they took me downtown onto Pennsylvania Avenue, and they parked the car. And they said, watch this. I said, well, we watch. He said, just watch. So we're sitting there, and I'm like, well, what's going to happen? And apparently, it was about 3 minutes to 4 p.m. And at 4 p.m., the street became flooded with people leaving the offices down there. And he said, these were other senior football players said, now take a good look. What do you see? I see, man, I see just tons and tons and tons of women. He said, exactly. And in Washington, D.C., there are 14 women for every man. I said, really? Guys, I think you got a deal. So they took me, signed up, and that was the beginning of my journey to the University of Maryland, was the fact that it was so close to Washington, D.C., and all these beautiful Black women. Okay, now what happened here? I think I got disconnected.
No, you're still connected, but I think your camera got turned off.
Oh, I don't know how that happened. Okay, so a telephone call came in. It interrupted us. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. We're back. Okay. So anyway, I was very excited about going to the University of Maryland also to play football, because they had a coach. His name was Lou Saban, and Lou Saban had coached the Broncos. I mean the Buffalo Bills up in New York with O.J. Simpson and people of that nature. And he was the advocate of what was called the modern pro football formation. So this was like modern. This was like run and gun. Throw the ball down the field to these guys that are fast and speedy. They catch it, running in for a touchdown. And I felt I was one of those people. That's what I like to do. I like to get the ball, run the end, run a pattern down the side of the field, catch the ball, take it in for a touchdown. So we thought, oh man, I think this is great. This guy, I'm gonna be a pro football player. That was my original concept of what I was gonna do. I'm gonna play pro football because I got Lou Saban coaching me. Well, little did we know, before we arrived for our summer training session, Coach Lou Saban had resigned his post at the University of Maryland and moved on to the Denver Broncos to prepare the way for the coming of John Elway. Well, so they gave us another coach who was a former All-American. His name was Bob Ward, was going to be the head coach. And Bob Ward's philosophy of football was what we called ground and pound, 3 yards and a cloud of dust. You know, take the ball. What are these people doing to me today? These solicitors are calling me. I'm sorry, I'm not on my my computer. Shoot, I don't know what I'm gonna do here. This is getting.
Well, I can still hear you even if the camera is off.
Let's go back to where I was. Okay, I think we're back. All right. I'm sorry, I think that's gonna happen because there's, you know, I'm of age where all these Medicare solicitors are calling me constantly. So I just don't know what else we're going to do, but live with it for the moment. Anyway, so we wound up with Bob Ward. Completely different philosophy of football. At that time, I weighed about 180 pounds, 185 pounds. And I was a speed player, not a ground and pound kind of guy. Give him the ball and run him into the middle of the pile there and try to dig out 3 or 4 yards at a time. And so this did not work well with me. Mm-hmm. And also, this was the University of Maryland. You know, I had been warned that you're going down right there below the Mason-Dixon line, Holiday. You know what you're getting into? I say, well, I can handle it. You know, I'm a New Yorker, man. I can adapt to anything. And so there was a great deal of racism that I was dealing with. Some of the players, you know, they had never played with Black players before. We only had a few Black players on the team. Mm-hmm. And so some of them were still carrying their very racist training that they had grown up in. And, you know, it was difficult sometimes. Sometimes I'd be running the end, I'd point to a guy that I wanted my split end to block, and he turned his head and looked the other way. He made believe he didn't see that guy. And so it was very difficult. And we all lived in the same dormitory. They had a high-rise dormitory. This was very nice. You know, mm-hmm. the varsity lived on the 8th floor, the junior varsity or freshman team lived on the 7th floor. And there was a lot of stuff that would go on that was racially motivated, and the coaches did nothing to absolve this because some of them were still operating on a racist mentality as well. So by the end of my freshman year,
what year did you enroll?
I enrolled in 1967, fall of 1967. So
okay.
By the end of that freshman year, I was decidedly unhappy. My academics were fine. I had one instructor. I'll tell this story a little bit later because I'm getting ahead of myself. But mm-hmm. I decided I was going to stay, you know, and make the varsity. I wanted to get my varsity accreditation. So I stayed into my sophomore year, and I played, and we were terrible. My freshman year was wonderful because we had a coach. His name was Dim Montero, and Dim was the equivalent of Newt Rockne, who created the game of football, supposedly. And Dim knew everything. He had been a coach at a boys' prep school where young men would go to prepare to fix their academic status so that they could get scholarships to go play football elsewhere. And Dim had a record of something like 640 wins and 14 losses. So he knew everything about. He was an old guy. We loved him dealing. It was like your grandfather was out there with us coaching the team. And Dim was, he was a nice man. He understood what we were going to, the Black players. And he tried to talk to those guys about us being a team as opposed to some type of racial dichotomy going on. And we won every one of our games as freshmen because Dim was just brilliant. He could make one change and the tide of the game would swing. And so we loved Dim. We loved playing for Dim because he let us play the game that we were recruited to play, which was throw the ball down the field, run the ends, and speed. So that was a great time for us. But when we got to the varsity, it all changed and it turned into ground and pound. And they had some coaches that were decidedly racist. I had one coach, he literally one day made me get injured. And because I had an afro, you know, this was the 70s. So I had afro going on there, the early pre-70s, the late 60s and pre-70s. So I had a big, you know, huge afro. I was from New York. And they, you know, had problems with that. They had problems with me and my mouth because I wasn't one of those Yasser guys and all that. I didn't do all that. You know, it's like, I'm from New York, man. What do you want? Okay. What do you want? You want something? Let's talk about it. But they didn't appreciate that kind of that mentality very well. And so anyway, I played that senior year. I mean, that sophomore year. And I played enough to be, available for or eligible for my varsity letter. So, but I got into some, you know, some stuff there with the one of the coaches. He decided, he was the linebacker coach, and he liked to do things to the black players. And he would run players off. So I basically, they kind of looked at me like I didn't fit into their program and they was trying to run me off. And I'm from New York. And I said, I'm not going anywhere till I'm ready to go somewhere. But right now I'm not ready to go anywhere. So one day he decided he was going to make me an example. And he had me holding the, what they call blocking dummies. It's a little, it's like a big pillow. But it's made out of the material that they use on trampolines and things like that. It's very, very, very durable. So guys come to hit you with it and you just brace yourself and they will bounce off of it and you don't get hurt. But he decided that when I hit this guy, this linebacker, when he came over to make this, we were doing a blocking exercise. I hit the guy back with the pad, you know, so he was trying to hit me hard and I hit him back and he bounced off of me. So now the coach, this is the coach and this is a critical moment. He says, he starts talking to me real bad before everybody, like I had done something incorrect. You see, this is football and I learned that you have to protect yourself in football. You don't go let somebody hit you in football. So he told me that I should not hit back. I should not defend myself. And so they tried to hit me again and I defended myself, but out of instinct, just I bounced this guy again. All right, so now he's really mad. Now he tells me, if you don't just stand there, we're gonna have a problem. What he was talking about was he was going to have me kicked off the team. So I stood there and this 245 pound, they switched guys. They put the captain of the team, guy's name was Lavrusky, put him on in the line there. And Lavrusky came, he was about 245 pounds and he just blasted me. And when he blasted me, my right shoulder was incapacitated. He almost broke my daggone collarbone. But my arm, my shoulder was totally injured. So I had to leave the field and go to the trainer. I tell the trainer what happened. Trainer says, that son of a bitch. And because, you know, they did this to other guys, other black guys. And it took me somewhere around 4 years before I could throw a baseball again, just with that arm, my right arm. That's how bad the injury was. It was all discordant. So at that point in time, that made up my mind, I've had it with these guys. But plus the fact we weren't winning. We were 0-8 in my sophomore year on the varsity. And I just had enough of that guy. So anyway, I started thinking about doing something else. And I had a lot of options with my scholarship. I had a lot of classes that I could take to just experiment to see if I wanted to be a part of those classes. And so I went to I liked theater because my grandmother used to take me to Broadway shows on my birthday every year. And so I decided I wanted to go into an arts class. So I took a seminar in the history of theater. And lo and behold, I liked it. And also one of the tutors from the football team was a grad assistant. So the bottom line was, the word was, if you attended class, you would get a C. If you attended class and did your work, you would get a B. And if you did some studying and attended class, you were going to get an A. And an A was great for me because it helped me stay eligible to play football. Because if you didn't maintain the 2.5, you couldn't play. And that would give them a reason to drop you from your scholarship. So I took that class. I aced it. And I liked the class. I liked what I was seeing. I learned a tremendous amount about the beginnings of the theater in the world and the art that goes into it. So I decided to take a beginning acting course that spring. I took acting, I guess it's 001, and the instructor was a gentleman by the name of Professor Roger Mearsman. And I'm in Mearsman's class. And Mearsman was delighted because I had some background from my high school days in Shakespeare. I understood Shakespeare, understood what Shakespeare was all about and how to speak the speech and understand what we were talking about. So I did a few scenes in acting one, and Roger really liked me. So came time in springtime, getting ready for spring football. Roger tells me, "Listen, I got something I want you to do." I said, "What do you have for me to do?" He said, "I want you to do this play," and he handed me a booklet, and it said "The Hairy Ape" by Eugene O'Neill. So I had come to know that Roger was a very unusual professor in that he was an impressionistic director. He created images with the people that are on stage. That's how he painted. He painted with people and their words. And so I said, "Well, let me do some study here, because I know Roger's not racist. He likes me. I became one of his favorites in there because I would do all the things that he was looking for in the classes." And so Roger had given me this script. I read the script. I read the history of the script, and on the cover, on the inside cover, it said that this play was debuted on Broadway with William Bendix starring as Yank, which is the role that he wanted me to play. Yank was the leader of a group of stevedores on a Atlantic ship, Atlantic crossing ship. They used to shovel coal. That's how they kept the engines going back in the original days of the engines there that they had. So these guys were all muscled, they were Neanderthals, a lot of them. They were very, very much like Neanderthals. But I recognized William Bendix's name, and William Bendix was the star of a television show called The Life of Riley. And he was a star, I said, so I read this thing, I read the piece, and I saw that this guy, he's a tough guy, man. This is good stuff. This is my kind of deal. Perfect for a former football player. So, I wasn't former at that point yet. Let me tell you, that happens. So anyway, I said, if it's good enough for William Bendix, I'm going to trust Roger Miersman to make it good enough for me, to make it very, very salient and prosperous for me. So I signed up. I started work on the play. So here comes spring football. Now, Bob Ward did not get along with the team. The team went on strike. We went on strike, and because of some of the things that were happening, not just to the black football players, but some of the Caucasian football players, and we were losing miserably. It was terrible. And he one day during the middle of one of the games, Dim, who was an assistant coach to the head coach, tried to make an adjustment with us that was in our defense that could have helped us out. And the head coach, Bob Ward, ran him out of the room and berated the man in front of us. And you know, it was like somebody berating your grandfather. And we lost all respect for that man at that time because we realized he did not care about any of us. So, you know, like them, if them asked us to move a wall of concrete 10 feet, all you're going to see is guys' backs and butts pushing on that wall, okay, immediately. They're not going to ask no questions or anything. They're going to move it for them. But for Bob Ward, everybody lost their desire to play the game. So Bob Ward, we went on strike. It was the first time a group of athletes were about to challenge the rules of the NCAA because what we wanted to do is, because they changed coaches on us, we felt that we had the right to change schools without having to sit out what they call a red shirt year. That's a year where you can't play, you can't practice, but you're out there walking around observing at your new team, but you can't compete. Well, we were about to go into all that when Bob Ward, he had a revelation and he resigned. Good deal. Okay, so Bob is going to get a new coach who is a high school phenom coach down right around in the area where the university is. And so he comes on board and he's interviewing the kids. Now, I had had a confrontation with one of the Caucasian football players because they decided they were going to call me some kind of stupid nickname, you know, but they were doing what they were trying to demean me. And I wasn't standing for it. So, you know, one day in the training room where all the football players eat, we're sitting in there and this little group of Caucasian guys on the team, players on the team, they decide they're going to have a good time and play with me with this nickname. And I told them, I said, listen, I don't want to be called that. And I'm going to tell you something. And I'm talking to this guy. He was a quarterback right across from me. Big guy. He was about 6'4", 6'5", and he was huge. But I told him, I said, if you call me that name again, I was buttering a slice of bread. I said, I'm going to put this piece of bread right down your throat, through your face. And so he looked at me. And he was trying to figure out what he was going to do because I had called him out in front of his little clique. Well, don't you know, a couple seconds later, he started to say the nickname. He got the first portion of the syllable out and there was a flying Batman coming across the table, flying with both hands around his neck, choking this guy, and he's turning purple. And they couldn't get me off of him. I wouldn't get off of him. I told him, I said, man, do you think I'm crazy? Do you think I'm playing? And so they finally got me off there. And of course, they send me to the coach like I did something wrong. I said, and I told coach, This was still Bob Ward, by the way. I told Bob Ward, he wanted to try to punish me. I said, listen, I told the guy what I was going to do. I told him he was offending me. He insisted on doing it. And I don't see why I was at fault for defending myself. I have ethics and I have self-respect and esteem. And if I tell somebody I don't want to be called that name, I expect them to adhere to that. So anyway, Bob Ward kind of let me go. But then again, he knew that he was about to resign. So he left and they brought this new coach in. So the new coach comes in and he says, okay, Holiday, I hear you're quite a character. I said, well, yes, sir. I enjoy playing football very much here at the university. I said, but right now I'm doing a major a stage production for the drama department. I've moved my major to education, speech and drama education. So he says, well, what does that mean? I said, well, there's no understudy for me. And so this is, I will only be able to play 1 week of spring football. It was 2 weeks at that time. And so he said, the next thing out of his mouth was, he says, well, Holiday, you don't have to worry about playing football at the university anymore. You can keep your scholarship and all the benefits, but you're not going to be playing football anymore. So I put on the long face, like, I'm taking acting anyway, so I put on the long face saying, oh, wow. Oh, no, I can't play football no more. And inside, I was saying, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. You have delivered me. And it was a deliverance, because what I was involved with the theater was, I was the first African-American that they ever put on stage in a lead role at the main stage at the University of Maryland at that time. It was called Taws Fine Arts Theater. So anyway, I went on to do the Hairy Eight, and it became a huge hit. Everybody, because we were beautiful, right? We were young. We were in these little Speedo bathing suits with glycerin and charcoal dust all on us. And we were beautiful. You know, they had a lot of beautiful guys up there on stage, of which I was one, the main guy. And they broke all kinds of records. They had never filled up that Taws Fine Arts Theater with a student production such as that. And they sold out all the tickets, the entire run was sold out quick as a bunny, because they did a big spread in the Diamondback newspaper with me in these big blow up photos in these very provocative different poses that were very, very, very artistic, but and also just incredible, showing people this new age that was taking place over at the theater department. There was a new guy in town, and he was not afraid to get out here and do stuff that was wonderful. And so that is how my transition out of football, into football, out of football, and into theater. Theater became my mainstay, and I directed, I wrote, I acted, and for my entire remainder of my career there. And then I had a great academic career with the theater department. And I have been earning my living on what I learned at that department for almost 50 years now. And I still work. Right now I'm involved with a major project of the Negro Ensemble Company of New York City. They're having a nationwide and international search for new scripts and new authors. And I am one of the readers and the director of the readers panel, and all the scripts that they are scrutinizing, I have to read and assess And whoever is going to win this thing, there will be five winners at the first level of the scripts that are assessed, and they will be given a elevated workshop production, which means they will have all the bells and whistles, but not the frills. Okay, and then out of that workshop production, the winner will be determined, and the winner will get a full production in the 2022 theater season of the Negro Ensemble Company, and that will be with a full production and all the bells and whistles and all the frills, as well as a financial stimuli. So if you have a script laying around that you have never shown anybody, but just might be able to turn the heads of these readers, I would submit it. It's all anonymous. I wouldn't know that it's yours if you did. And there's no hanky-panky on this. There's no crossing of symmetries or anything of that nature. So that's what I'm doing right now. I've got 15 scripts on my board. I've completed the four, and done the assessments on four of them, and I'm moving on to the fifth one a little bit later on this afternoon. So that's the beginning of Kenny at the University of Maryland. I made friends with Mr. Earl Wynn. He was, you know, I had to recruit Black folks to work with my work, because I was doing primarily Black theater while I was at. I brought Black theater to the University of Maryland. I was doing works by Imamu Baraka and Donnell Lee, and I was taking poetry and turning it into shows. So hold on one second, please. Yes, ma'am, I'll be down. Thank you. Okay, I'm in a hotel here, so they give me my time. And so anyway, I had Mr. Earl Wynn. I recruited Earl Wynn to be my partner. We became friends for life. We are friends to this very day. He was one of my mainstays as a lead actor for me doing some of the Black theater pieces. We did Brazen in the Sun together, and we did quite a few other things. And I had a little clique that I had formed. Young lady that I eventually married, Jennifer Baker from Baltimore, was an actress that came there. And Carla Witcher, Belinda Cooper, and Jay Stewart were my little clique of actors. And most of them went on to do some really great work. Jay became a great actor and a writer. I caught him walking across the plaza of the university one day, because you know you can see a Black person from a mile away walking on there, because there was like 24,000 people attending that school every day, and of that 24,000, 127 were African Americans, and of the 127, 77 of them were athletes. So mm-hmm. when you saw somebody on the campus, you know, you waved at them, at least even if they way over on the other side, and they would wave back. So one day he waved at me, and I said, hold up, you ever think about doing some theater? And he said, nope. I said, would you like to try? He said, yeah. So I said, here, and I handed him a script. I said, meet me over at the Towards Fine Arts down in the little theater downstairs. It's called ET, Experimental Theater. You meet me there on Saturday at 10 o'clock, and I'm going to do auditions that day. And that was the beginning of a lifelong relationship and friendship with Jay Stewart. We became really good friends. I mean, everything that I did, I tried to involve Jay in, and Jay tried to keep me involved in the things that he was doing. I went from when I graduated from the University of Maryland, I went to the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill. And I was a member, I became a member, I auditioned and became a member, a founding member of the Folger Theater Group, which is the Folger's Theater Company. Created by a gentleman named Richmond Creakley. He was the artistic director, and he kind of liked what I did. And I had another buddy there named Dallas Teat, and it was the two of us. We were the two Black Shakespeareans in Washington D.C. at that time, and I stayed there almost 3.5 years. Working at the Folger, and then Richmond got a big elevation to go and be number two in charge of the John F. Kennedy Center. And when he went there, there was some talk about him offering me an opportunity to go there. But Robert Hooks at that time was starting a professional Black theater company called the DC Black Repertory Company. And so Jennifer, who I eventually married, Jennifer and Jay and Carla and Belinda, they all went up to do these workshops at the DC Black Repertory Company. That was the preliminary test for them to become members of that company. And they wanted me to come. And I said, man, I don't do no workshops. You know, I had the big head. I'm Shakespearean, man. I don't do no workshops. You know, I've been doing this stuff for a long time now. But one day I was doing a show. As a matter of fact, Kathy Bates was on stage with me in this show. At that time she was called Bobo Bates. But anyway, so we're doing a show, and this at the end of the show, this very large African-American gentleman came over to shake my hand and say hello to me. And Jennifer was with her, and she was introducing us. You know, his name was Moto Jico. I said, okay. But his real name was Vantile Whitfield. And Van was the artistic director of Robert Hooks' DC Black Repertory Company. And Van was inviting me personally to come and participate in his workshops. And I said, well, you know, I don't do workshops. He said, man, everybody do workshops with us. You come on up and check it out, okay? And so I did. I went and I checked it out, and I wound up being there 4 years. And in the fourth year, I was the director of the training center. I handled all the auditions for people trying to get into the theater, and anything else that Moto Jico asked me to do, I did, and Robert also. So that was a real training area time of my life in theater. And that's how it all kind of opened up and came to be. I want to tell you about this professor that I had. I had a professor named Tom Starcher, and it was for speech one. Now, my major was speech and drama education. So I have to get at least a C to move on in a class. That's in my major. This guy, because I was from New York, because I was an African-American, because I was a male, because I was a Black male, gave me hell and gave me a D. I never got a D in any class since I had been at the university. Gave me a D in my major. So that meant I could not move on until I took that class again. And at that time, I was still involved with football. So I had limited selections that I could take to to get that class. So I had to take Starcher again. Don't you know that son of a gun gave me a D again? Two D's in my major. So, I mean, I couldn't figure out, you know, I knew what was going on. And this was just pure racism. And, you know, he did things to embarrass me in the class. And, you know, but I maintained my cool. And eventually, the third time around, something happened with Starcher. I think he got ill. I don't know. But the head of the department, Ms. Hester Provinson, took over that class in that slot. So there I was, and Hester asked me, say, Mr. Holliday, I see here that you've taken this class twice. What is that all about? I said that Tom Starcher gave me a D in my major twice. She said, that son of a bitch. I said, yeah, he didn't like me. He didn't like men, hippies, blacks, or black athletes. And I was all of that. So I was in trouble with this guy. every time I looked around, I was in trouble with this guy. So, you know, I did the best I could. I learned as much as I possibly could to refine my speech techniques, because I felt that at some point in time, you never know what you're going to play in the business of theater. And so mm-hmm. that's how I let all that work. And we can talk about something else now, if you wish.
Okay. Well, you touched on a lot of things I wanted to talk about already, but I do want to back up. You said that the football team lived in the same dorm. Do you remember which residence hall it was? One of the high rises?
Ellicott Hall.
Ellicott Hall. Okay.
Yeah, and Ellicott Hall, the 7th and the 8th floor.
I also wanted to ask you, when you entered the theater department, there had been African-American students in that department, but no one in the lead role.
Let me tell you something. The only thing that they had African-Americans doing prior to Kenny Holliday coming on there with Yank was a guy walking out there with a tray talking about more tea, sir. You understand? That was it. That was the extent of their ability to act at the University of Maryland. I ain't carried a tray ever. I've done so much stuff there. I changed everybody's mindset about African Americans, first of all. I changed their mindset about what we were, what our potential was, because I became the guy. I became the guy. I was the go-to guy. For directing and for acting, I was the go-to guy. And I love that. I love that.
Did you feel any resistance from professors in the theater department or from other theater
aides? Yes. Yes, there was one particular professor. And I guess he felt like, see, what when I got there, when I was doing Yank, I also made friends with the queen of the department, who was a Caucasian girl. She was a senior, I was a sophomore. So she left school at the end of that year, that my sophomore year. And mm-hmm. But he kind of felt like I had sullied the dignity of the department when she decided she wanted to know me. Okay, and I didn't have anybody at that time. I was just a baby, and she, you know, that was my first love, if you will. And mm-hmm. she was smart as heck, brilliant woman, and we're still friends to this day. She's a great writer, and one of the things that she did when she was young was when computers were just coming to the fore at that time, she wrote manuals about how to operate computers for people. I mean, that's where her mind was really at. She was a brilliant actress also. She tried Hollywood, it didn't work for her at that time, but she's doing quite well. She's got a husband and a theater that they have built, I think, somewhere in the Midwest there. and she's doing well. But this guy, he gave me the blues. He's always trying to undercut me. And so I understood what was going on, and I feared him not. Okay, and that was the other thing about it. I feared him not, and if he gave me too much trouble, I would go tell Dad, Roger Mearsman, and the head of the department, Dr. Rudy Pouliez. I go tell him, say, this is what he's doing to me, and they call him, talk to him, but he was he thought he was the star of the daggone place, and I mess with him. Whatever he wanted to do, it was fine as long as he didn't bother me, and I had to take him for my master directorial class, and I gave him the blues when I directed, because I brought in some serious hardcore black theater, and did some things. I did some stunts. I did stunts, that they still talk about. Because I wasn't having it, and I wasn't going to let him just roll me over. And, he got me back. I found Jean Sartre. And I decided that existentialism was the way that I was going to have to go to deal with this man. So my act of existentialism was that instead of typing out my final analysis of my final major piece, I was going to put it all on a cassette recorder. This way he had to sit there and listen to my butt for a good 2.5 hours. And so he did that. And he gave me an A, and I got an A plus on my stuff. At that he was honest about. But he wouldn't give me my cassettes back. He said, I have to keep them for a year. I said, okay. So I came back 1 year and 11 days later, and he told me he'd just thrown them away. And I was ready to take him apart because it was some classic stuff. It was the essence of the beginning of my career. It covered all of that in that existentialist presentation. But he had to get me back, so that's what he did. He threw it away. You throw somebody's thesis away because they didn't come pick it up in 2 days or 10 days. After they have submitted it, they probably try to suspend you. But they got away with this kind of stuff. And so there was one other level I want to talk about. Okay. I was a student teacher. Okay, I got a student teacher assignment in my senior year, and it was at one of the local schools there, predominantly Caucasian. There was a few black kids there, but predominantly Caucasian. Caucasian supervising teacher. So here's what she did. They would come every 2 weeks and do an assessment on you. And it was okay. That was cool. Huh? I'm sorry? Anyway, so they would come.
I think you were frozen for a second there. Can you go back? The last I heard was... You student taught in your senior year.
Yeah, so I was doing my student teaching, and I went to one of the local schools around the university, and my teacher was a Caucasian lady, a middle-aged Caucasian lady, with the Nancy Reagan kind of hairdo and everything, and they would come every 2 weeks and do an assessment. They would sit in the class, professors and undergraduate grad student would come and assess my classroom demeanor and acuity. And I, every 2 weeks. So I think it was an 8-week student teaching assignment. So at 6 weeks, I had 3 A-plus ratings on my observations. So they're like, you handle your classes well. You're a very interesting teacher because you have a wide range of information. You like to work with me. Okay, I think it's gonna come back. There's somebody else who's trying to call. Okay. Hear that. Let's see if it'll come back. Come on. Come on. Come on. You hear me?
Or yes, I can hear you.
Okay, you can hear me, but you can't see me yet. Here it comes. Here it comes. I've never had this happen before. I never did it. But anyway, so in the last week, for the last 2 weeks, I decided I was going to close it out with a student production, a small student production. So I gave everybody an assignment to go home and think about what they wanted to talk about in a theatrical presentation. And so they did. And then one of my students came in with one, said, this is something that my big sister, she's in college and she's in education. And she says, this is a very popular writing that is being passed around. And so I said, well, let me see what it is. So she handed it to me and she said, well, let me explain what it's all about. It's about students not having the right to have any kind of direction in their own education, that we are, you know, basically we are fodder. And so I looked at it, it was called The Student as Nigger. Okay. Now, you know, if I was a normal person, that would have sounded the alarms would have gone off, you know. But I said, you know, it's about, I know what it's about here. I understand because I have fought this in my own classes about being told something to do that is not even salient to what I'm supposed to be trying to accomplish. And so I said, okay, this is what we're gonna do. So I sent everybody home with a copy of The Student as Nigger, which was just a little essay thing. And on Sunday evening, I got a telephone call saying that I didn't have to worry about coming back to the school anymore because I had been fired. All right, so somebody's mama saw the word nigger. They didn't read the piece. They just jumped to conclusions and they fired me. Okay. All right. So now I had Dr. Meersman had a good buddy who became like one of my quasi uncles. His name was James Michael Bailey. James Michael Bailey Esquire. James Michael Bailey had tried 2 cases before the Supreme Court and won both. Okay. So I called James Michael Bailey. I said, listen, these guys, they're trying to steal my education and my degree. They just hijacked my super, my student teaching class and all my credentials and everything at the last moment. I mean, I'm 2 weeks away from graduation. So he said, listen, you go over there to the head of the Department of Education. And you tell him exactly this. You tell him, and I'm going to talk to Roger Meersman. Okay, so I went over there and I told him, I said, listen, you guys are going to have to fix this because I got 3 superlative ratings as an educator. And they obliterated all of that and looked over it and decided that they had to fire me because they didn't like the way that this thing was labeled, and they never read it. They don't know anything about it. So anyway, they said, and I said, if I don't get another assignment or somebody doesn't fix that, I'm going to promise you, there's going to be a building on this campus with my name on it, because I'm going to sue this place like you ain't never seen before. So it took them about 4 days, 4 or 5 days, and they came back to me and said, we have an assignment for you. You got a new assignment. And they sent me up to Columbia, Maryland, to the, I think it's called White Rock, was the school. It was an open space school. It was a new experimental school. And they said, we think that you'll fit in better up here at this place. I said, but you know what? At that time, I was still living down on 3rd and 8th Street in Washington, D.C., right there by the Folger. And I had to drive from there all the way to Columbia every morning and be there by 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so I did that. And when I got there, I met my supervising teacher. And I don't want to hear a bunch of nonsense. What is it that you want me to do here? And he said, well, I've been trying for 7 years to win the state drama championship. I said, that's what you want? You want to win the state drama championship? He said, yeah. I said, I'm going to take care of that. All right. So I called my team and I went in and introduced myself to these students, and I laid it out to them what I was going to do for them. I wanted them to bring me the materials that they wanted to talk about, whatever it was, whatever form it was, bring it to me and let's talk about it. And we're going to create a championship show. And that's what we did. These kids brought in everything. They brought in music. They brought in excerpts from different plays. They brought in an excerpt from Raisin in the Sun. And I did put poetry together for them in there. And we wrote some things. I had them write some scenes. And so we got that all together. I had Jay Stewart and Jennifer and Belinda and Carla come up and help me out with them. And we went into the regionals and my kids stomped them. Now, when we got to the regionals, I saw a lot of my upperclassmen or people that had been my upperclassmen who were now teachers. And they put such a paltry offering on the stage. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what in the world, man, happens to you when you become a teacher? These guys look like they got emasculated or something. They had nothing. There was nothing there. There was no essence. It wasn't sharp. It wasn't imaginative. It was just bad. And my kids just stomped them, all right? So then we go to the finals. And same thing kind of repeats again, except it's more people from different parts of Maryland that I've also had dealings with. Some are writers and some who were actors that I acted with. And they put also the same paltry type of work on stage to represent what their school was all about. My kids had this hot piece and they were wonderful. I had 30 something kids on stage working in unison, and all the tech guys backstage, they were all kids. I didn't have any adults working on the thing. All the kids did it. And they wrote, they directed, I mean, they wrote, they sang, they danced, they rehearsed. They did everything. They did the lights. They did all the special effects and everything. And they learned everything that they were supposed to know about running a theater and building a show. And we won the daggone state championship. When they announced it, when they made the announcement at this little dinner after the last show was done, I pretty much jumped out of my chair, and I looked like one of those cartoons where the rabbit's feet start running while he's in the air, to get up there and get this trophy. And I did that because my superior to, all right, let's go. There we go. Come on. He was trying to get up there to accept it, you know, like he had done something, but it wasn't his production. It was my production. And so I got it. And we put those two trophies were the first two trophies in that school's, because it was brand new school, in that school's trophy case. So, and that kind of put that, you know, that was the exclamation point on my career at the University of Maryland.
I have a couple of closing questions. One is, were there physical spaces on campus that you felt really comfortable at during your time there?
Me, I felt comfortable at the drama department.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had, you know, I had a couple of girlfriends that lived off campus, and that's where I was comfortable. I'll tell you where I wasn't comfortable. Mm-hmm. I would not go anywhere close to Fraternity Row down there off of Route 1, because them boys had, you know, I know what the stars and bars were, and they had weapons, you know, that they would use. There was some people that claimed that they were shooting BB guns and pellet guns at Black kids that were walking by that area or tried to walk around that area. So I did not go to town hall to drink beer down there, because that was, you know, where all kinds of maladies could take place, because once they got a little beer in them, they, you know, they might decide that they wanted to have some fun with me, and I wasn't going to do it. So I did not go there, and I did not hang out with the Black kids in the university's cafeteria. Some of them hung out at the student union and in the cafeteria. That was not for me. That was what we called, what I called the dropout, you know, hangout. You hang out in the student union playing bidwits and all that, you're going to be punched out. So I never went to those places. I was in the theater working.
Mm-hmm. And what has been your relationship with you and with University of Maryland since you graduated? And what year did you graduate?
I graduated instead of June of 71, like I was supposed to. I didn't graduate until January of 72. So I'm officially mm-hmm. class of 72. That's never set well with me, but that's the way it was. Let's see. So what was, say the question again, once again.
What has been the nature of your relationship with the university since graduation?
I've not had one really. I have tried to, I tried to generate a summer program, but you know, my wife, my first wife, who was Jennifer Baker. Jennifer passed away, and you know, I had bad life there for a while. I was an alcoholic for a good deal of the time. Today, I'm been sober man for 34 years without any breaks, without any vacations. But Roger Mearsman, it really hurt him when Jennifer passed away. And I also lost my son 3 years prior to that. And, mm-hmm. and you know, when Jennifer died, I think he felt that I had, you know, I had loosened the reins, and I had not taken good stewardship of her. But I did my best, you know, that's mm-hmm. all I can say. I did my best, and I loved the woman incredibly. And, if you know that Roger put the kibosh on anything that I tried to do at the University of Maryland at that time, mm-hmm. I think he would, because he wouldn't talk to me. You know, Roger had a major tragedy that took place in his life. He became, after I left, a couple of years later, he retired from the university and he became a local critic of all the different theatrical and entertainment genres that was going on. So he would go see all these plays and then and write these wonderful reviews. Well, he wanted to get his eyes fixed. He went to have eye surgery. This is back in the early days of LASIK. And he went to get his eyes fixed and they botched the deal and they blinded him. So that took away his joy. He loved going to theater, to watch theater, whether it was bad theater or good theater, he loved going there and he couldn't do that. So he turned very bitter in his older age. And it was really sad. I tried on several occasions to go see him and he wouldn't even talk to me on the phone. So I had enough pain going on. I did not continue to try to generate some type of relationship with Roger anymore or the university, because the university was, they went right to him to find out who I was when I would try to establish some programs there. And Roger would put the kibosh on it. That's how I assessed it, because he would never talk to me. And I was, I was teacher's pet. I was Roger's main guy, because all he had to do is tell me what he wanted me to do, and I'd get it done for him. And all of that other stuff. Well, it was painful. It was very, very painful. Earl Wynn was president of the student union, the Black Student Union. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Earl real close with all the political things that we were doing, the marches and the protests and just changing. Our job was to change the vision. I'm coming, man. Change the vision of Caucasian people about African Americans, for us not to always be looked at as some type of unusual entities, and that we would stand up for our rights, and that we studied just like they studied, and we had the acumen just like they did. So that was major portions of what was going there.
Okay. And my final question is, when you think back over your time at UMD, and if you had a chance to talk to current or future students, what might be a word of advice or encouragement you might give them?
Well, I the University of Maryland, I don't know how many colleges they have on campus now, but I know it's more than 24. Mm-hmm. They probably got something like about 35 different colleges and different specialties. And the work is very important, that they look at the work. Do not let people's personalities contour you away from the work. Don't let them... you can't let people there, because there's still a lot of people holding out old behavioral patterns that they were taught. They don't know any better. They don't want to know any better. And they are still going to be that way. So you can't, you go do the work. Apply yourself to the work, which is the essence of success. No matter what the objectives of other people, don't let them discourage you. Do the work, and then the work will carry you through down the line.
Okay. Sorry. I want to thank you for taking the time to do this interview with me. If I have any follow-up questions, is it okay to email you?
Yes, please do. I apologize. I have my other hotspot working in about 25 minutes here, and okay. We won't have this problem ever again. Thank you. I had to learn a tough lesson here today, but I appreciate your patience.
Okay, no problem. And again, thank you for the interview. We can close out here. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Thank you. Mm-hmm.